This is a podcast from meow.net.
Meow!
As a social practice artist, I sometimes visit schools and lead creative activities with children. Teachers tell the class they must be good listeners. But what is a good listener? Am I a good listener? Listening can be hard to describe or define. It depends on your relationships, your context, your intentions for listening. I'd like my community-based art practice to be open and collaborative, and so surely listening is very important. My name is Hannah Kemp Welsh, and this series is part of my research into listening within social art practice. In these episodes, I speak to socially engaged, community and participatory artists to understand how they listen within their practice, what gets in the way of listening, and what the consequences of listening might be. Episode 3, Sam Metz, Listening Through the Body. I became aware of Sam's work in 2017. Whilst working with the youth programming team at Nottingham Contemporary. Sam was doing thoughtful work with young people with disabilities and additional needs, creating space for participants to respond to artworks through touch and movement. Alongside their work with sculpture, Sam has a socially engaged practice. They write, "I'm interested in exploring, co-producing and defining new moralities for social structures that are safer for neurodivergent people." So we get a sense of the context of your work. Would you be able to start us off by saying a little bit about your practice? What does your work look like?
So my work has a couple of strands. My most recent work has been involved more in consultancy, so looking in museum and galleries at different creative access approaches that incorporate neurodivergence, so considering different modalities of understanding that aren't written or spoken. And alongside this, I'm also an artist that's kind of making work.
Thank you. And in this same vein of context setting, if you could say something about how projects tend to arise. Are they commissioned? Do you work with institutions? How do these projects get started?
As a history of working, I had a commitment to a gallery maybe like about 6 years ago, which I think is where perhaps you know my work from. And that would be ongoing connections with various community groups. Kind of moving on from that, I worked in programming, kind of producing within museum and gallery spaces. So I would be working directly facilitating and also supporting other people to facilitate work with community groups. I have like a wider research program that's very much individually driven by a project that I want to do, which I'm in a very lucky position to be able to do and is funded by a group called Necessity, who are a great funder for kind of socially engaged work that has social justice elements. And so from that, I'm able to connect to different organisations, particularly like artist-led projects, supported studios that have community groups within that I can work with. So that's more how I'm currently working, as well as being approached by a couple of art galleries more recently to do community work.
Are there community groups that you're particularly interested in working with, or that you have like a specialist relationship with?
Yeah, all of my work is centered around working with neurodivergent people. So I used to work much more broadly, like schools, primary schools, a range of community groups. Really lucky to work with asylum seekers and people in vulnerable housing, which is fantastic work. But I've really honed down because of my own lived experience of neurodivergence and the understanding that I think I have to say that actually I need to specialise.
I'm not sure if this is important or not, but I did want to ask, Is there any language that you use to describe your practice? Are there particular words that you use to describe this way of working? And are there any terms or words that you avoid using?
I very much code switch when I'm working with a community group. So I wouldn't ever say, so we're doing a socially engaged project. I'd say, we're doing this art project. We're going to make this. Would you like to? And I think the language that I've picked up is very much from institutions. When I started out, it would be community work. And then it shifted to participatory practice was really common as a term. And now people are saying socially engaged more. And I think maybe there's a move away from that term now as well. But yeah, it's very much shaped by funders and institutions. And it's not a language that I'm necessarily always comfortable with, but I do find myself using it. But as I said, I wouldn't use that language within the community group. So it's almost like an outside term, I think. And actually, you're making me question it now even more so. So you have this like hidden back end of the project that you're complicit in, and that perhaps you aren't always communicating to a community group on an equal level. So there's a disparity there that's often put in place by the organisation that you're working with. So I think language is important, and maybe I need to be more transparent and have a more universal term.
And I understand that when you do this work with community groups, for want of a better term, that work is collaborative.
I advocate for co-production as a model, and I also think it's impossible. I think in like trying to do it, you're making good steps towards a good project, but you're always limited by having to have had a description of the project prior to starting for a number of stakeholders that are involved that aren't the community group, whether that's the organisation or whoever it is. And therefore, you're already kind of putting limits on what the project can be. So, yeah, I think as much as I can, I like my work to be process-led, but so much is defined prior to starting work with a community group. And even if I advocate, and I often do when I'm working with organisations, I'm like, this planning meeting shouldn't happen then. We need to get the community group in at that point, because very often projects are rushed through. There's funding for working with community groups, but the go-ahead isn't given until like last minute. And then so much has been agreed. And I try and fight back against that and say, let's halt this and let's bring the community group in. But it isn't always possible. So I think it's kind of flawed, but however, I do push for process-led work, which can be really difficult. Like the reason for doing that is because traditional educational models aren't always most appropriate for the groups that I work with. It's really hard to describe a project where you say, we're just going to put some stuff together and see what happens, because there isn't the reassurance that comes with having a better defined project. If I came in and said, oh, we need to make a film, that would like reduce the possibility of participants' different modes of communicating. So, it might just be a different way of working. But like for the work that I do, I need to be really responsive to like all different kinds of input. So not just kind of talking about what you're interested in, but sensing what people are interested in different ways. A lot of my process is setting up kind of atelier spaces, so workshops that have like resonant materials available that don't necessarily have a fixed way of using them. And so kind of selection is really important across all my practice, that selection can be made in like an embodied way that suits the person that's making that selection rather than an enforced way. But that doesn't mean that I don't make certain decisions within that space, because I'm really passionate about embodied communication. However, there are conflicts within working in a process-led way for decision-making for neurodivergent people, in the sense, like, for instance, I'm autistic, and if I don't have a certain amount of structure, like you introduced the session today and say we're going to have a break at this time, that's really reassuring to me. So there are certain decisions that need to be there, I think, to reduce people's anxiety, but also in order for people to be able to freely communicate and have decision making on an individual level about the way that they work, there also needs not to be fixed outcomes about the possibilities of using materials, particularly in a workshop.
I was wondering if you might have an example of perhaps an activity that you do when you're working in that collaborative way.
I do always get people to do my drawing is stimming activity, like I just do no matter what group I'm working with. So not necessarily just neurodivergent people. I do latterly like quite a lot of work with students who are interested in neurodivergence in their course. And I always get people to follow this practice where they're drawing, but also kind of listening to the sounds of them drawing and doing repetitive mark making and looking at the shapes of the marks that they've made and considering that bringing themselves back to their body. Stimming is like a self-regulatory behavior very often done by neurodivergent people, particularly it's known within autism, but it can be things like hand flapping or making noises, repetitive movements or sounds. It's often viewed like negatively, and people don't always see it as a way of languaging and as a way of expressing joy, actually, so sensory joy, as much as it can be from overwhelm. So it's just basically a drawing activity that enables a safe space to stim. It's a project that I developed more over lockdown for people who I thought would potentially be masking their behaviours a lot more because they'll be around and it, families or partners or kind of not going to spaces that they're used to and having those routines. So it allows you to do all the repetitive actions that you might want to do in a more physical space, but in through drawing.
I'd be so interested to take part in that. I was wondering if we could talk about listening. It seems to me as though listening is really important within that practice.
I'd say all of my work is connected to ideas around wider listening, so not just listening to someone talk, but listening through the body. So it's important for me as a practitioner, like a facilitator, to be aware of things like micro cues, particularly from nonverbal participants, that acknowledge things like refusal, like if a participant doesn't want to be involved. So it's me looking and observing, but it's also me being aware as someone being like a receiver or receptive to communication that I don't have all the tools necessary for listening. I very often work with support workers who are much more familiar with participants than I am, and it's really important that I have a good relationship to them and listen to any clues or cues that they're giving me about the participants' comfort levels. But yeah, like more widely through my practice, I kind of almost talk about like touch as being a way of listening as well. Like, as maybe I don't use the word listening, I might use the word interpretation. So kind of a lot of my work is about encouraging repetitive touch through that idea of stimming that I explained earlier as a way of interpreting artworks, for instance. So you're kind of getting feedback that's an embodied feedback rather than listening to someone talk about an artwork.
Thank you. It's been so interesting to hear your perspective on listening based on your experience of working with nonverbal participants. I feel that's been a really valuable addition to this conversation that I've been trying to initiate with practitioners on the topic of listening within social art or community participatory art practice. Thank you. Ways of Listening is a series for Meanwhile in an Abandoned Warehouse, a podcast about cultural democracy in community art. Show notes with links to the projects discussed are available at meow.net. This episode was recorded and produced by Hannah Kemp Welsh.